So I realize I was muted for that, but I'm sure you can hear yourselves chanting this wonderful poem. So as I promised, each week I try to give a little background about Sherdu. So here's a story from a book called Zen Masters of China by Richard McDaniel. Sherdu was born in Guiyao, which at that time was a very primitive area. He was described as being a well-behaved and generous child who was bright and self-confident beyond his years. Orthodox Buddhists attributed these traits to the fact that his mother, contrary to local custom, chose to refrain from eating meat during her pregnancy. Many of the people in Guiyao still lived in caves and worshiped the old gods who demanded sacrifices of wine and cattle. From an early age, Sherdu was skeptical of the value of these practices, so he desecrated the shrines in order to see if the supposed gods would retaliate, which they didn't, and he freed the cattle from their pens. Stories about the sixth patriarch had reached even this backwater, and when he was 13 years old, Sherdu traveled to Baolin to become Huineng's disciple. The patriarch died within a year, and Sherdu among the monks gathered around Huineng, just as hey, Sherdu asked him, "Master, what should I do?" "You should go to Qingzi," Huineng instructed him, but Sherdu misunderstood him to say Qingzi, or seek thoughts. Sherdu interpreted this to mean he should observe his thoughts during the practice of meditation, a technique advocated by certain teachers of the day. Seeking to follow what he understood to be Huineng's advice, he dedicated himself to sitting in meditation, observing his thoughts as they rose and passed away. One day, an older disciple of Huineng asked him how he was practicing. "I'm following our master's instructions. I'm observing the rise and fall of my thoughts." The older monk gently suggested that Sherdu may have misunderstood the sixth patriarch and told him he should go seek out the master's heir, Qingwan, Qingzi. Qingwan had several monks studying with him, but when Sherdu presented himself, the master remarked, "I have many cattle with two horns among my followers, but just one." So that's our story of Sherdu for tonight. Next week, I'll have a story about his encounter with his master. So first of all, I guess we discussed the first two lines last week and asked you to take some notes and have some reflections. Anyone have a comment they'd like to offer about the opening of this poem we're studying? And Hannah's going to handle the putting you on the screen.
Well, if you just put in speaker view, that would be automatic. So you won't have to hassle. I have a question about the word "where" in the first line. So it says, "I built a grass hut where there's nothing of value." Does that mean the hut is built where there's nothing of value, or does it mean there's nothing of value in the hut, which is how Ben Connolly seems to interpret it, but the English doesn't quite work?
No, and in fact, as I mentioned last week, the nothing of value character is the character Mu, or
Robert, is anything different in your computer setup that you're cutting out?
You want to say it? I don't think so.
Okay. We'll just trust the gods. Yeah, I missed most of what you said.
The character for nothing is Wu or Mu, and so one could read this as, "I've built a hut empty of value, or with entirely without value, without even specifying a location." Is my understanding.
Okay.
Other comments or thoughts?
And I'll just ask you, if you want to talk, unmute yourself and put yourself on speaker view. Do you know how to do that?
I
you don't have to do it, Bob. The person who's talking.
I see, okay. All right, so I'm unmuted.
You're unmuted.
Okay. So any other comments before we kind of dive into the lines 3 and 4 and then 4 through 6 or 5 through 8, I should say?
I just wanted to mention how perfectly beautiful the introduction is by Ben Conley. He was so generous, and be present when you read this book. It's good for your prep. Meet the poem with interaction based on wellness and a generous way of being. It was just so bountiful. His the way he asked one to be while reading this book was just perfectly beautiful. And I'm trying to do that too.
As we all should.
Yeah. So don't miss the introduction.
So lines 3 and 4, and I should say that this today we're going to have 6 lines because we only did 2 the first week, but in the future, mostly we'll have 4 lines to kind of contemplate. But these lines, when it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. We talked the other day about what does this hut kind of mean or represent. In one of the early metaphors in Buddhism, and the Buddha speaks in the Dhammapada, where he makes this kind of mind being, the hut being our mind, quite explicit when he says, as rain leaks into a poorly roofed house, so does passion invade an uncultivated mind. So in this case now, we're dealing with a house that's just been built, but these weeds show up. So it immediately raises the question, what are weeds? What is a weed? So a couple of thoughts here. There's a fable that tells of a gardener who tried everything to get rid of his garden of weeds. And he couldn't do it. In exasperation, he contacts a famous expert who inquires whether he's attempted a variety of remedies. When the gardener replies he's tried all of them, the expert pauses and reflects and finally replies, well, all I can suggest is that you learn to love the weeds. Our teacher Suzuki Roshi in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind has a lovely passage, and he says, when pulling out the weeds, we give nourishment to the plant. We should rather be grateful for the weeds because eventually they will enrich your practice. If you have some experience of how the weeds in your mind change into mental nourishment, your practice will make remarkable progress. You will feel the progress. You will feel how they change into self-nourishment. We must have the actual experience of how our weeds change into nourishment. So, and other commentators and people have thought about this and say, well, think about our body. Our bodies, the weeds are our aches and our pains. They're evidence of our mortality. And our thoughts certainly are like weeds. They just show up. They keep emerging. And our practice really helps us understand that they're neither good nor bad. Now, it's interesting, again, having the benefit of looking this poem over with my Chinese scholar friend, Paul Hansen, that the first character in this line means completed. So Shiryu is saying completed this hut, but it's made of grass. So is it completed? It's only completed in this moment because he clearly knows that it's going to break down and decay. But then the next line, the first character starts with ruin. So he begins to say completed and immediately it's ruined. So in a sense, these two lines are really about the whole cycle of coming and going, of emerging and decaying, of the whole cycle of life and our lives. There's a, just for our benefit, I've also looked at some other alternative translations besides the Kaz Ta-Nehisi, Daniel Layton, and James Mitchell, another translator, translates these lines as, the grass thatching still looks new. When it wears out, I'll add fresh thatch to the roof. And what's interesting, again, the Chinese characters, the character for thatch, it's pronounced Mao, and the character for all grasses is chao. And so in the poem, the distinction is made between the grass for thatch and all other grasses.
What was important for me, what came up was on page in chapter 4 on page 36 regarding what we're talking about. And in there he talks about here's what we do with the weeds. Here's what we do with the weeds that keep coming up is to practice to be with the weeds. And it occurred to me just when I read that and a couple other similar sentences was that I keep saying, oh, I'm overwhelmed. There's too much that comes up that I don't know what to do with. And when I read this, all of a sudden that dissipated and that said, you know, practice to be here with the weeds. So and I just wanted to mention that just one little phrase can twist a whole line of thinking into more positive.
I can add what Janet was saying about the weeds. I was watching my reactions today at the inauguration, which I probably spent way too much time watching, but it was wonderful. And looking at how I felt on January 6th, and then looking again at how I was feeling today, and thinking, well, am I supposed to be equanimous, you know? And I was really, this whole period of time, you know, people have died and I've been sad. And then something uplifting happens and I've been joyful. And I have really been appreciating my weeds because they've really been putting me in touch with the feelings, some of the sadness, some of the anger, and all those feelings that other people have been going through. And I feel a real connection to both both sides of this, all the stuff that we're going through. So I'm glad to have my weeds, and I've learned a lot from them, and I hope I continue to have them.
You can't get away with it without them.
No, I think really the point of that passage I read earlier is no matter how hard you try to kill the weeds, they still keep coming. There's no avoiding their emergence. And it's sobering to think that a thistle seed lasts for 100 years in the soil. So no matter how hard you try, they're still going to keep coming back.
So I have a couple of things that I want to say. One is, as a gardener, so somebody once sent me one of those kitchen magnets, and I think it's relevant here. As a gardener, your first mistake is to think that you're in control. And the other is the definition of a weed is something that you don't want in your garden. And like we all have these different definitions of what a weed is. And, you know, when you think about it, like people eat dandelion leaves, right? While the rest of us are like trying to get them all out of our garden. And
so it's gonna be medicinal.
So just, you know, like seeing those, bringing our preferences, bringing our likes and our dislikes to whatever our definition of weeds is. If we can just leave those behind, it makes such a big difference.
Well, someone pointed out, those of you who have Ben Connolly's book, one of his kind of commentaries is that Sherdew hasn't created some ideal weed-free realm. He's here with what keeps coming up to practice with the weeds of delusion. The weeds of difficulty. Chris Burkhardt a couple of Sundays ago gave a really great talk about how we need the uneasiness and discomfort of delusion to fully accept the dukkha of our lives, to be on this continual path of transformation and growth. So if we see weeds as obstacles, they're obstacles. If we see them as weeds, they aren't obstacles. Again, how our minds make sense or not of the phenomena of the world. In kind of figuring out this talk, I came across a little passage I'd like to read you, and it's both, and it's an homage because Mel Weitzman passed away, I think, last week, and a great teacher for many people in this lineage. And he's reflecting on Dogen's line that we chant in our Sunday, in our Saturday service, from the Genjo Koan, yet in attachment blossoms fall and in aversion weeds spring up. So Mel's commentary on this is, in Zazen, we are continually confronted with aversion and attachment. We want something nice. We all want something pleasant, something that feels good, a wonderful state of mind. Sometimes when we have a wonderful state of mind with no pain, we think, ah, this is it. This is great. This is all worth it. That's why I'm here. But as soon as we grasp onto that thought, it starts to change. It's changing anyway, whether we think that or not. We hold something and then it starts to crumble, starts to change. Then we say, oh, but wait a minute, don't go away. And it continues to change. Then it starts to get painful and we're not happy. We want to hold on to that state of mind. But as soon as we hold on to it, we start to suffer. Try to be aware when you have a good feeling like that and just enjoy it. When it starts to change, just let it go. When you're not open to everything, you suffer. Dogen said, flowers fall with our attachment. We want something so bad, and yet the flower falls and weeds spring up. It is difficult. It is hard to be open to what you would ordinarily be averse to. It's counterintuitive. When we have pain or discomfort, we usually want to change it. As Suzuki Roshi said, we're continually changing our equipment, moving around, trying to get comfortable. And as soon as we get comfortable, it changes and it becomes uncomfortable. This is how things are. The way to be comfortable, to have true comfort, is not through trying to control the world around us, but to adjust ourselves, to open ourselves from the inside. And when we open ourselves from the inside, absolute and relative are transcended. Subject and object are no longer duality. And we can accept various states of body mind without being a victim. So thank you, Shojin Mel Weitzman. And I took that kind of as a good segue to the next four lines. The person in the hut lives calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, he doesn't love. So just open up for a minute. Any first comments that people have about these lines and how they might reflect on what we've just considered about the hut and the weeds and the person living there?
Well, I've been working on trying not to get so tangled up with when I get upset about politics, trying not to feed that and other things. And the line, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between, really registered with me, because what came up for me was just to flow. You know, if I get upset, okay, just be upset, but watch it and let it move instead of kind of grabbing onto it and feeding it. And it was really quite helpful. And then I was reading a part of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and Suzuki Roshi talked about the way to control like an animal, a sheep or a horse, is to give them a big pasture, mm-hmm. which means just let them roam. So let your thoughts arise, watch them, and let them go when it's time to go, but don't try to hold on or contain them or get rid of them or any of that. So it felt very similar to not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. So it really touched on what I've been working on.
Mm-hmm. Good. Other thoughts?
Yeah, along what John is saying, I had kind of an aha moment on page 45, second full paragraph. And he says, there's an odd thing. If we turn to look inside and focus on seeing thoughts and emotions, rather than being caught by them and believing the stories they tell us, those very things that we thought were us, ourself, or our inside, becomes objects of our consciousness, things that we observe, they are now outside. You know, and that just, I hadn't really considered how permeable that inside-outside state is. But it almost sounds like there really isn't much of a barrier between inside and outside that leads me into the thought that, you know, we are all one, and it makes that kind of a lot more real for me. So I was real thankful for that.
Yeah. Another comment? Thought?
Yeah, it seems like, you know, in my own practice, I have to learn over and over again because there's so much impulse to try to pick the weeds and remove the weeds that I need to learn the lesson over and over that if I just allow the weeds, I want to pick the weeds to open the space in my mind, but it's actually when I just allow the weeds that the space can open up. But then any grasping for that space just creates new weeds. And so like to sit with it without any preference, that seems like this what this is pointing to.
One perspective that seemed to make sense to me as I was reading these passages and had been looking for other reasons at the Lotus Sutra, came across a passage in chapter 14 that called Safe and Easy Practice. And it says, a bodhisattva takes his stand on perseverance and is never alarmed in mind. And with regard to phenomena, he takes no action, but observes the true entity of phenomena without acting or making any distinction. This is called the practice of a bodhisattva. So I think that's that same sort of John's kind of stepping back and observing without being attached to that observation. Ben points out that one of the things that happens in this first line of this passage is all of a sudden we've gone from I built the hut to now it's the person in the hut, which kind of shifted perspective from the first person to the third person. He proposes that pronoun shift indicates a kind of letting go of attachment to the individual, about kind of moving to a state of calm abiding. And if there's an aspect to our practice, it's to find that place tranquility, of peacefulness, of calmness. And whenever I think about that, living calmly, there's a great line that Robert Aitken loves from Wallace Stevens, where he says, the day is like wide water without sound. So that notion of living calmly, that image to me is a really helpful place to keep coming back to. John mentioned, and Scott as well, not being stuck to inside, one could say not being stuck to meditation, not being stuck to outside to the rules of or expectations of others, not being stuck to in between, not being stuck on meditation, not being stuck on our calmness, but realizing that changes too. One of Sherdu's kind of one-liners that is kind of helpful, I think, is he says, what the eye sees is the way. What the eye sees is the way. And what the eye sees is not separate, it is all mind. If we're, to me, the operative word in that sentence is the stuck word, not the inside, the outside, or in between, but it's the stuck part. It's the attachment to a condition. And so to me, this line really speaks to kind of a lesson on non-attachment and not even not an attachment to the to thinking we have to meditate. The attachment is to any notion of structure or content we have that our minds bring forward. Let me read another passage from the Lotus Sutra, the same section, because I think it ties right to this not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. And right back to what John was speaking to as well. Moreover, one should not hold to things as higher, middle, or lower, constituted or unconstituted, real or unreal. One should not seek to grasp things, know them, or see them. All things are empty and without being, without permanence, neither arising nor ending. This is called that with which wise people associate. In a quiet place, one can master one's mind and heart, dwelling as peacefully and unmoved as Mount Sumeru, regarding all things as non-substantial, like empty space without solidity. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, he doesn't love. So this seems to be addressing kind of the social aspects of withdrawing from the world. Here he is in his hermitage on top of this rock, in this grass hut, and he's not hanging out with anybody. So let's take a minute and sort of reflect on what that's telling us, and what we bring forth from those lines.
I have a comment. I think of the historic part of where Shirdu built his temple, and it was a very popular place. There were many temples up there, or at least a number of them, and they were quite beautiful, and he was invited to inhabit one of them, and he chose not to. So that would, to me, be the worldly people. And at least on a really snapshot look at all these temples and then this little grass hut, he was really living that.
22 years.
And, you know, the rest just points back to admonishments we get in our practice by so many of the things we read, where we're reminded that we don't have to have riches. We don't have to have the outside comforts that we may desire to have a rich life.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts, comments?
Yeah. So I was thinking about this idea of shifting from the first to the third person. And what occurred to me is, like, it's kind of like when you're telling somebody about a dream that you've had, where it's like, well, I was there, but then I was looking at it from over here. And that parts of the poem really give me this sense of, I almost feel like I'm interpreting a dream. Mm-hmm. But that dreamlike shift for me was kind of the paradox that it can be both ways. And then that was tying into the idea that we're both, like, separate, but we're also really interconnected. So that's where I was going with that line.
I had that same thought as I was kind of struggling with the shift from first person to third person. And it occurred to me as I was kind of wrestling with that he was napping. He said that from the beginning and never woke up from his nap. Maybe everything else is a dream sequence. On the first to third person, just a curiosity, Bob, whether you talked to your Chinese scholar friend about that?
Yeah.
I found myself wondering, and I know it's addressed in the commentary to some extent, but I wonder if he had some additional thoughts about ruling out translation issues or, you know, linguistic anomalies.
No, and in fact, in this passage, person is the pronoun. Later on, there's actually a place where Ben keeps the translation as the third person, where he shifts back to the first person.
but in this passage, it's definitely third person. It says person. It's that like the two-legged kind of character. If you look at the front of the book, where you see a two-legged character, that it's a person. So it's third person for sure.
It seems like the shift from first person to third person could represent a shift in identity from the self to no self, or a shift from the perspective of the relative to the absolute. And in the first paragraph, where there's the identity with the self or the perspective of the relative, the hut's covered with weeds, illusion. And in the third paragraph, if this represents a shift to no self or the absolute, the person in the hut lives calmly without any preference.
I think that's what Ben is inferring by him saying that it's a, this moving to letting go of attached to the individual, kind of just seeing himself as just another person in this hut and having his attachment sort of evaporate, his connection to himself is gone, and it's simply another phenomena in the world. One of the interesting aspects, of course, of Sherdu being a hermit is withdrawing by choice, and these passages about realms and worldly people. Generally speaking, people who were hermits, if they were educated, became hermits because they decided or weren't able to get a job with the government. And government jobs were in these kind of worldly places. When he talks about palaces and towers, that's where you would inhabit if you were a well-trained person in China at that time. So he's, in one sense, is kind of stepping back from urban life. And one of the things that struck me is, you know, in our, I'll call them city lives, we still have choices where we spend our time and our attention. And I came across one of my favorite philosophers, a black minor league pitcher named Satchel Paige. And Satchel Paige has some great aphorisms. And one of them is, go very light on the vices, such as carrying on in society. The social ramble ain't restful. So, and I think one of the messages here is, if you want to have peace and be calm, being involved in the world at large in society is probably not the recipe that you want to follow. So in one of the questions then is, how do we find that kind of calm place in our rambling lives? Because we all kind of live a rambling life with the interactions and people we intersect with. But I wanted to bring a different perspective to bear on this, where he's living. There's a line that I kind of, I guess got, took as a meditation koan from the Diamond Sutra, from a passage that reads, don't dwell upon colors to bring forth the mind. Don't dwell upon phenomena of sound, smell, taste, or touch to bring forth the mind. Dwell nowhere and bring forth that mind. When he's talks living, we could use the synonyms to dwell or to stay. To me, one of the messages here is, it's kind of going back to that stuck notion of earlier, that we have a choice. Robert Aitken and an essay of his on the mind of clover called Bringing Forth the Mind says, he calls it living the unborn, the mind that doesn't dwell upon phenomena, that experiences the inside and the outside, the inner and the outer as one. So actually, dwelling everywhere and nowhere and then bringing forth that mind is part of our task, part of our opportunity when we sit and practice. It means not rejecting anything or clinging or attaching to anything. It means a kind of spaciousness. It means each moment we have an attitude of openness and acceptance. It's kind of, in a sense, it's very much parallel to complementary to the issues we were talking about the grass hut and the weeds. This is really, where do we choose to live? But it also raises a question I'd raise to you, which is, if this person doesn't live where others do and doesn't love what others love,
where does he or she live and what does he or she love? So let me throw that question out, turning his statement inside out. Where is this person living and what is he loving or she?
In that line too, like it's not saying where other people live or what other people love, it's where worldly people live and worldly people love. So I don't read it necessarily as being really isolated or apart from all others, but I kind of hear it a little bit as not living or loving in that realm of keeping up to others or comparing with others what they're doing. Should I be doing more? Should I be doing less? And wanting to be above average. It's just kind of letting that go, stepping back from that somewhat.
Other thoughts out there?
I just want to read out from the chat because Carrie put something there. Not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. I appreciate Ben's commentary. Whatever is right here now is what we have to work with. So our hermit just works with what he has and doesn't need what the worldly people love or where they live, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Or getting back to what Bob had said earlier, what the eye sees is the way.
Yeah. I'm just quoting Shirdu. I don't have that kind of wisdom. So,
and where is that? That's from his sayings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, you're talking about inside, outside, or in between. That got back to the change in person from first person to third person. And it's like, you know, first person is I, which is the observer. And all he does is change to the third person, which is outside of him, which is the observed. So the only thing that really changes is still the same narrative, but the point of view changes. One way he's looking from self out, and the other way he's looking from other back to the self. So it's pretty much the same thing, only the point of view changes. It'd be like that a few pages down the road. He was talking about the mule looking down the well and the well looking back at the mule. Let's see. There we go. It's similar to what he says a little later on about the mule looking down at the well, and then the well's looking back at the mule. So it's a similar thing where you have an entity looking from both directions, and the center is anybody's guess. I really don't have a handle on that.
Other thoughts out there? If not, maybe.
You want to do breakout rooms, Bob?
I have a couple of questions for people to consider. So we'll take 10 minutes and go out in breakout rooms, and I think we'll have actually a few minutes to have people say a few things if they care to when they come back. So three questions. Take any one or all of them. First one is, how do we recognize and embrace our impermanence and the emergence of difficulties? How do we recognize and embrace our impermanence? Second is, where do we live, really? where do we live and how do we live? And the third is, how much are we driven by social expectations, internal dialogues of achieving something, even perfection or enlightenment, as Talis's talk on Sunday was focused on? How much are we driven by our internal dialogue about achievement and reaching some point? And let's take those questions and go to breakout rooms and
kind of bounced around a little bit there.
How do we recognize and embrace our impermanence?
Yeah.
Where do we live, really, and how?
Mm-hmm.
How much are we driven by social expectations and internal dialogue?
Okay, got it.
I mean, and maybe in the future, Hannah, we can put these up in the chat room. I'm sorry that we didn't think about that. We're learning this technology.
I got your back, Bob.
Thanks, Tim.
So please stay tuned for breakout rooms. Let's see. Just a moment. Oops.
It worked, Donna.
Did it? Do you see? Are there people in different rooms? Looks like room one is everybody. I'm fearful that I've not put people into. What they need. All right. Oh dear. Oh.
Take another run at it.
I hope you're all enjoying this gaffe. Okay. Do we have time?
John was on a run there. I'd like to hear what else John had to say.
Okay, go for it.
It just seems like with many things in Buddhism, you try what Buddhism recommends. You try to approach things in that way. And does that reduce your suffering or not? So are we better off to come to terms with impermanence and learn how to live with it and see it and accept it? Does that cause less suffering? Or are we better off, acting like it's not going to happen? And I think I know the answer for me, I know to that question, but I think we all have to make that decision for ourselves. Certainly our culture recommends pretending impermanence doesn't exist.
Well, as they say, you can run, but you can't hide, hey, John?
Yeah. And as you get older, you can't run very fast.
Well, he's exactly not running, right? He's relaxing in the hut.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Speaking as a gardener, I find that every fall season that comes is a reminder of impermanence. Because you see things that you loved in the summer, they're flourished, and then they wither and pass away. And always the fall is special to me for that recognition of how things come to a close.
I want to say that for me, one of the most dramatic, I guess, impressions of impermanence has come from aging. And I don't know, reaching when you reach 70, it seems like things start really to change really fast. And there's at first this feeling like, tomorrow I'm not going to feel this way. Tomorrow I'm going to feel like I was when I was 40 or even 50. But that doesn't happen. And after a while, you begin to recognize that and you recognize, next month is going to be different. And another 5 years from now is going to be really different. So that's been a real lesson for me in impermanence.
Other thoughts out there? Other images that were triggered by these lines?
I'm just thinking about your question about where do we live really? In some ways we live in the outside world, like in our homes, where we go to work, where we shop, walking down the street. In other ways we live, in our internal world with our thoughts and our feelings. And then there's that in between kind of, because we kind of integrate those. So I think that goes along a lot with his thing about not being stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Let me kind of move between all of those a little bit.
Comment on how we embrace impermanence. I would suggest that I embrace impermanence every time I feel fear or anxiety. And I find that that's usually connected to, like, why is there fear? And it's probably connected to impermanence or possibly something going wrong or being safe. And that's kind of what's come up for me in that respect. It's recognizing impermanence when we're unconscious of it. That's to me the challenge.
I'm really interested in what Claire said in terms of Sangha life, that I wonder if what we love about coming together to the Zendo, whether it's real or virtual, is like we're all kind of setting aside our usual external world and entering into a shared Zendo world where our internal world can kind of be more present or something like that. I don't want to think about that some more, but I thought that was interesting what you said, Claire.
Something occurs to me about both impermanence and where and how we live, in that, you know, the grass hut was not permanent yet. We build permanent homes to live in. And the grass hut had many leaks and holes in it, and it was essentially no different from living in the outside world. And in our culture and society and states of mind, all of our homes are designed to protect us, isolate us from the very things that our studies tell us we need to acknowledge and become a part of. So in so many ways, we, by living in this modern world, we live a total contradiction of what we purport to embrace.
It's interesting, as I'm listening to what we're all saying, the thought that comes to my mind is that the closer we live to nature, the more we recognize impermanence, whether it's our own bodies or nature around us, or the house that we live in being made of steel or wood or grass.
I think that that's right. There we go. That's a perfect way of looking at it. I think looking at nature, you're looking at the totality of things being born and dying, getting used to that cycle of growing things and things that are terminating. And I think looking at ourselves, I think we have to practice looking at ourselves in the same way, looking at it from the third person. You know, we're just part of the sangha, or, you know, the state, and not forever. But I think it's important that we look at ourselves that way and become comfortable with that thought of looking at ourselves as just another skin bag, instead of waiting until, you know, until your time is up and dealing with it all at once.
Or maybe in some way integrating the two, which is what the poem seems to be suggesting, to build the hut and to live there and to be outside the hut at the same time, right? To love ourselves. I think, Bob vanished and returned. Yeah. Says, Bob, how do you like to, do you want to close these just with the closing Dharma chant? That'd be good. Any advice for us for next week?
I apologize, my computer just went to say I don't have service. We'll read the next The last passage on this first page, ending with "Will this hut perish or not?"
Well, we can't actually hear you, but I think what you're saying is to study the next four lines.
It looks like basically the next stanza of the poem in the book.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah.
Cool.
And the next stanza. Yeah, and hopefully my internet tubes will be cleaned out by then. Yeah, I don't know what's going on. Just kind of froze up for about 5 minutes here. Last passage on this first ending with Will.
Harry asked which line of
impermanence.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah. The next stanza.
Okay.
Internet tubes will be cleaned out.
Okay.
So let's clean out with a chant.
Okay.
May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks. Zazen and 30. Everybody,
thanks for bearing with the technical difficulties.
Yeah, no problem. Deal.
Shall I end the meeting?
Yeah, and then I'll start a new one.